Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 10th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Griscom of Left Reckoning, woo, joins us to break down the news of the week. And later in the show, Samanthi Kumar, campaign organizer for Housing Justice for All and NYC DSA co-chair, and DSA organizer Silianos Karolitas, will join us to talk about New York's historic slate of DSA candidates. Meanwhile, the January 6th House Committee held its first public hearing last night in primetime, which included never-before-seen footage of the insurrection attempt. We'll play that for you later in the program, or at least part of it. Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney was front and center last night. The committee found that Trump had a, quote, seven-point plan to overturn the election based on their investigation, and much, much more. The New York Times is backing up evidence that Uvalde cops waited for over an hour to confront the gunman, even though they knew that there were more than a dozen injured but alive children inside. The drip, drip, drip continues. In Michigan, a police officer has been charged in the murder of Patrick Loyoya, who was killed at a traffic stop by being shot in the back of the head. New data shows that the Biden administration accelerated expulsions of Haitian migrants in the month of May. The U.S. will end its requirement for travelers to test negative for COVID before entering the country, a win for the travel industry lobbyists, who seem to be winning a lot lately based on airplane prices. And lastly, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill yesterday that would expand Social Security benefits and fully fund the program for 75 years through increased taxes on the rich. It's a pipe dream, but it's always good to have these ideas out there. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. Sam is not here, as you may be noticing. It is not a dire situation. He is just up. I don't know. What can we say here?
He's in Worcester for an event.
I didn't know if we could do his location.
He's getting the keys to the city.
Yeah. He is back up in Worcester, and he's fine. He had a dental emergency on Wednesday.
I believe he is doing fine.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just his. It was just he needed his crown replaced.
It was just a combo of he was already scheduled to be off Friday.
Yes,
was off Thursday already, and then Wednesday it happened. So yes. It's just three, you know, inopportune things.
Right. But now I get my choice of guests, of clips, of topics.
The power.
It's overwhelming. Although, Precious. Frankly, there's not a lot of topic diversity today.
Certainly not.
You know, and appropriately so, frankly. Last night was the first primetime January 6th committee hearing. You know, I am all for publicizing this. Ideally, when you're going into a midterm election or an election, you have both your gains that you've made if you're the majority party, if you have the presidency, the Senate, and the House. Democrats don't really have this. And you also have negative partisanship. So if they don't have much to show for the former, which is frustrating as hell, go to town on the ladder.
Well, and also, I just want to say, like, even if this hurts them electorally, it's still worth doing.
Still valuable. Like,
getting this all on the public record, I think, is... And I'll just make another note on, you know, insurrection is the term that I think is being widely used. I don't like that, because that's a rebellion against state authority. These people were appealing to state authority to overturn the results of an election against the will of the people. So I'd like to just call it a coup attempt. And that's what it was. It was a coup attempt. And it was a dress rehearsal for coup. And it's an active project to continue to try to make sure that they can swing an election that they lose.
You referred to it as a dress rehearsal before we started, or either you or Bradley, it all blends together in my mind. And that's exactly what it seems like. And so laying this out in clear and uncertain terms is valuable for both electoral purposes, but the larger, more important existential question of authoritarian far-right mob rule and trying to combat that.
And you just the organized right-wing parties not like deciding that we're going to opt out of democracy. I mean, you see this in Brazil, you see this all over the place.
Yeah, and I was appreciative too of the committee's diversity in terms of the topics that they decided to cover on night one, which I'm sure is what is going to get the most eyeballs. So, I mean, they both focused on Trump. You know, one of the parts of the testimony was that Trump did not make one call to the Defense Department or any agency during the attack. And Pence was basically calling the shots. Mark Milley testified to that effect. There was also testimony from Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards, where she talked about slipping in blood in the Capitol. Testimony from a documentary filmmaker following the Proud Boys, which what I was appreciative of was that emphasis on Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and their coordination and their attempt to do this in a systematic way to overthrow the election and overthrow the will of the people.
Yeah, they had fascist goons. I mean, Enrique Tarrio visited the White House, and it is good, like I said, to put all this stuff on the record. Now, there is a reaction like, oh, this stuff is sort of previously uncovered, and it was just previously unregistered by, you know, the people who should have been taking this seriously as a coup attempt in the lead up to it.
100%. And so we're both emphasizing Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, but also Donald Trump's connection to them as well, and the coordination. His stand back and stand by comments. Something that stuck out to me in the hearing was they interviewed a Proud Boy that was cooperating with them, basically Jeremy Bertino, or former Proud Boy, who said that membership tripled after Trump's stand back and stand by comments during the election leading up to this. So there was a ton of stuff. Ivanka Trump admitting that she took Bill Barr's statement that Trump lost the election at face value. Bill Barr self-servedly testifying that he stood up to Trump and told him that his election stealing claims were bullshit. So these were just some of the highlights from last night, or lowlights for that matter. But the thing that I think most people are going to focus on, because it's the most visceral, is this video of the unseen footage from the January 6th coup attempt. There is some violence in this, so I want people to be aware of that, but I think it's incumbent upon us to play some of this. This is about a 10-minute long video, but we're going to play around 5 minutes of it. Here is part of the previously unseen footage, body cam footage, security cam footage, compiled together with a timeline by the January 6th committee.
There's a crowd surge heading east.
We love Trump! 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 We love Trump!
Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and for the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you. I will tell you right now.
Thank you.
control of the volume station. Priority. We just had Moses be circle, breach the line. We need backup.
Madam Speaker, the Vice President and the United States Senate.
We're going to give riot warnings as soon as the outlet is here. We're going to give riot warnings. We're going to try to get compliance, but this is now effectively a riot.
49 hours declaring it a riot.
5 to 50, be advised, Cal Police 1 advised they're trying to breach and get to the Capitol.
Yeah, copy.
We're about 5 minutes out. We're trying to make our way through all this.
Breach of the Capitol to the upper level.
Jack, be advised, they're requesting additional resources on the east side as they have broken into that window and they're trying to kick it in.
Without objection, the chair declares the House in recess pursuant to Clause 12B of Rule 1.
This is a rioter reading Trump's tweet out loud on a bullhorn.
We lost the line. All of you need to get back. AOPD, get back up to the upper deck. AOPD, get back to the upper deck. ASAP.
All right, I think we have a good picture of it. At a certain point, there's also footage of some security officers barricading the doors to the chambers there. Wow, Antifa really got into character there.
It's worth reiterating that there were people armed among that. Police did seize weapons among that crowd, which you wouldn't know if you followed, for instance, like Glenn Greenwald's Twitter account, which repeatedly said that it was a completely unarmed sort of group. I think it's amazing that only one person out of that group was shot. I think it's a frankly amazing feat of restraint. And it's interesting that the right wants like you to throw a pity party that Ashley Babbitt got shot. Like, I frankly, like, I'm not shocked at all given like what was happening there and then trying to breach the inner sanctum, which we didn't get to that point, but like that was a coup attempt. And
although we should say that, you know, multiple people died, it wasn't just in terms
out of results of
yes,
that. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it was a coup attempt. And like, I mean, we didn't show, I don't think, the full footage of, they aired this last night, and I was flipping back and forth. I watched a good amount of it, though. And of the cop, one of the cops who died, literally, you know, falling to the ground, essentially, and their families were there. It's just a bit of hypocrisy, given that crowd is supposedly pro-cop, but it's only really if it's in opposition to black people, which is a good reminder. Say if a black militia group did this, what would have happened? What the reaction would have been?
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, like, if this happened in response to the 2000 election, I would have felt bad for, like, the individuals who were caught in the crossfire. But frankly, it's not a huge crime. This is a crime because it was built on a lie.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Like, in the 2000 election, you can... I mean, that election was
stolen. It was stolen
by the Supreme Court.
And people didn't... And there was, like, some, like, you know, strong letters written. And I'm not saying that would have gotten, you know, saved democracy or even led to good things if Jan 6 would happen in 2000. But I think the important thing to note is that violence there that committed by those Trump supporters was done to service a political lie from one of the major parties in this country. And that party continues to follow that path. They've been, like, not at all humbled.
Liz Cheney is likely going to be voted out.
Yeah, exactly.
Because her polling numbers are so dismal, given her front-facing, given how you know, aggressive she's been. And I loathe to give a Republican credit, but it was hard not to watch last night and be like, all right, you know, that's at least a principle to hang your hat on, which the Republican Party is usually devoid of. And I will also say this, too. I think that there's a section of people that think it's uncool to talk about January 6th because downplaying it means that you're in some way opposition to, like, the mainstream media that really can only talk about it. You can do multiple things at once. This was a dire, insane attack on by a fascist right-wing mob, and it's necessary to talk about. Just because CNN and MSNBC are breathless about it and so excited to air this because the only thing they care about is protecting institutions and their institutionalists, and this was an attack on the institution, doesn't mean that's the only value in it, in that it was an attack on our institutions, which, in my opinion, are already quite rotten. What we care about is the fascist element, the right-wing mob element. And it's not uncool to talk about, and I think some in, like, the lefty influencer space feel that way. Or, you know, because they only see themselves as in opposition to MSNBC or whatever. It's important to talk about. And another thing I was reminded of when you see that mob charging through the hallways there is how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was mocked for believing that she would get sexually assaulted by that mob. They came with zip ties and they came
mocked
with
by people
nooses.
Who live in gated communities, we should just say.
100%. So just she tweeted something last night like this, reliving this is you just feel like you're there all over again. And I can't even imagine what that must have felt like for someone like Ilhan Omar, someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in that time. With that said, folks, we're going to take a quick break. But first, this program is brought to you by one of our favorite sponsors, if not our favorite sponsor, Sunset Lake Sebede. If you use this code, left is best, you get 20% off Sebede products. I basically use this every day of my life. I use the tincture when I'm just trying to relax, but I also use the gummies that have melatonin and CBN in them. Recently, the newer product from Sunset Lake, I used it last night, and I slept really well. I slept really, really well. I couldn't, I'm just like, I'm scatterbrained, so I keep losing where that little, where the gummy container, and when I found it last night, I was so thankful, and I had the best sleep I've had all week. Couldn't recommend it more. They have fudge, they have gummies, which are very tasty, unfortunately, for everybody here, because I can't stop eating them, but
the
I have to stop myself.
Yeah, those ones are like so delightful in every way. They taste good and they're also super effective.
Super effective. So if you're having trouble sleeping, if you just want to relax, Sunset Lake Sebede has you covered. Again, use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off Sunset Lake products. Sunset Lake Sebede.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by David Griscom. We are back, and we are joined once again by David Griscom of Left Reckoning. Thanks so much for being here, David.
No, I'm always happy to be here, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Welcome back. It's another Texas-centric week in the news, so we had to have you, honestly.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and I know the subjects that we're going to be covering are a little dark, so if I could just bring a little brightness. We got to celebrate right here in my hometown of Austin, the Starbucks at 45th and Lamar won their unionization vote. So congrats to all of them for that hard work.
There's been a couple here in New York, but, you know, nothing really in this Brooklyn area. I want to go to one of the unionized Starbucks and give them my patronage because I've kind of been like not going there. Not that I have for a while, but I want to eventually do that. So hit them up today, maybe.
Yeah, well, to skip to our DSA conversation, but Kristen Gonzalez has 4 Starbucks in the city that you can go to tonight to buy Union Yes coffees.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
On her Twitter?
Nice. Yep.
All right, I'll check that out in a sec. All right, well, that's awesome. And the rate of successful Starbucks unionization, I mean, their batting average right now is out of control. The organizing there has been so, so effective.
It's truly inspiring. And like, it has to go this way because Starbucks has committed so much money and people to try to stop this effort. But having it being like a wildfire system like it is now is really great because they can't squash them all.
Right, exactly. With that said, we just played, and we'll get into some of the other news stories that we discussed, but the main one today, seemingly, we were looking for clips to play on the show, and it's just all January 6th stuff, but you know, appropriately so. I think I mentioned that I feel like there's sections of the left that are uninterested in talking about January 6th because the obsession about it from liberals and MSNBC is about, you know, institutionalism, which I reject. And I think I don't want to speak for you, but I would not say that you're, you know, obsessed with like the decorum of the Senate. That's not how I would characterize your. But I mean, the real crux of this is this was a fascist right wing attempted coup, and I do like that the Democrats are making the public reckon with that in a public way.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been keeping up with it a little bit. It's the January 6th stuff is difficult because there's like the conversation about like the actual events and what should be done in response to it. And then, of course, there is like, you know, the media hype people who are trying to continue their never Trumper career all the way back in, you know, the 2022. But like, no, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I mean, I'm be curious to see what comes out of it. I mean, I think more than anything, the thing that I'm most interested in seeing is a little bit of a stronger investigation into the relationship between law enforcement, not just in Washington, D.C., but across the country and these far right movements, because those were the arrests that startled me the most, is what I'll say about that. Along, obviously, with the Proud Boys who have just been, you know, marching around the country and causing trouble. And I think that they're certainly the, you know, the target of a lot of the attention right now, and rightfully so. But I see much more police than I do Proud Boys, basically. So I'd like to see that being investigated a little bit more.
Right. I mean, that is a great point. It is. I'm interested in like the overlap outside of, say, the DC police, mm-hmm. with some of these right wing paramilitary fascist organizations and law enforcement. That's something that piques my interest.
And, you know, just saying for personal experience, like, so I went to college in DC and I was at J20 when Trump got inaugurated. And I got, you know, my head cracked in by a police officer for just sort of standing on the sides while they were kettling protesters, right? So I've seen the kind of brutality that you can get from DC police. And I do think the argument that people have made that, you know, there was a kind of easing these folks into the Capitol is something that's very alarming and very different from my experience, both protesting Donald Trump and in Black Lives Matter protests throughout my time in DC as well.
So let's turn to Texas, because obviously the fallout and the drip, drip, drip of police misconduct and cover up from Uvalde. We don't know what they're covering up yet, but to me, it seems like they're covering up something big. And at the very least, it's complete incompetence. But more likely, it's, I think, cowardice that led potentially to deaths. The New York Times, in its fashion, is piecing together reporting, and like they add their credibility to it. So now people are taking it seriously, what we've known for weeks, that the Uvalde cops were waiting for over an hour, despite knowing that children were injured in those classrooms. There were something like 33 children and two teachers in that classroom area. And there were kids that were like bleeding out. And it seems like cops knew that and did not act quickly enough. I mean, what's your response to some of that information? It's not particularly surprising, but it seems to be for a good chunk of the country.
No, I mean, and it's just sometimes hard for me to talk about because I can't imagine doing that to those kids. But I think it's time, too, to also turn our anger to law enforcement, which I think very much failed in their duty to the community. Here. And before we get into some of the new information, you know, Matt and I talked about this on Left Reckoning almost right after it happened. One of the most despicable things that came out of the early reportings was the cops were blaming one of the teachers,
right,
who valiantly defended those children with their life. And as he said in interviews, plus he since, you know, he didn't have a bulletproof vest. He got shot in the back. He got shot a couple times and thought he was going to die. And he's been in and out of surgery since, you know, the beginning, since the shooting. And the cops blamed him at front, said that he had propped open the door for the shooter, which turned out to not be true, right? And it's just so despicable that the first thing that these police did after failing their community, failing these children, was immediately try to blame, you know, one of the people who actually was trying to protect those kids. From what we've seen, I highly suggest people, there's a piece in Texas Tribune that really has started to map out this story that just came out. And every time you read these new updates, it's even more shocking than it was initially. And it was shocking, you know, the day of. We're seeing not only that the police have been lying, that they have been shown to be cowards and put their own lives over the lives of these children and the lives in their community, but they have now completely gone rogue. So one, you know, the DPS, Texas DPS, initially was defending the police department and then gave them the most mild criticism, saying, yeah, there are probably some mistakes that were made, which I'm sorry, just any kind of analysis in any situation, if that many children die, mistakes have been made.
Yeah.
And then the Uvalde Police Department has now said that they will no longer cooperate with the DPS. They also, just yesterday, this came out, that the city of Uvalde lawyers have sent Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, a laundry list of records that they are saying are exempted from public disclosure. So there's now going to be a long legal fight on the city level and on the police department level to just get the information out before even a judgment or decision is made about what to be done about this. They are fighting tooth and nail to just get this information out public. And I, you know, obviously you can only speculate at that point. What is it that they're trying to hide? But I think from the information that we have about how they acted in that moment is pretty damning. Along with the fact, you know, you have to remember that, you know, Uvalde, like a lot of other small towns across this country, the police department budget is the highest line item on their budget. And this is what happens through a massive disinvestment in public good in society, that these guys are able to suck up a lot of money and then they don't actively protect people in their community. They're more likely to harass or shoot a citizen than they are to save them. And in Texas in particular, right, one, through what Abbott has been doing on the state level, as I talked about last time, has been just, you know, funneling billions of dollars to an unaccountable DPS here and the state troopers here. They are not used to, I mean, DPS again has like come back, right, from their initial statements, but people probably saw those early videos of the head of the Texas DPS coming out and sort of defending everybody up front, and they look like a bumbling idiot because they are not used to ever being challenged or being held accountable, because that's the state of affairs in the state right now, and it's a deadly, there's deadly consequences to that.
100%, and I mean, what's so maddening about this, too, is I guarantee you there's going to be a swell of people saying, well, this is why the police need more funding. But, like, mm-hmm. their equipment was more than enough. Their resources were more than enough. More than enough. They had everything they could have needed. And what mm-hmm. really stood in the way here, seemingly, was the officer in charge of operations, the chief, I believe, basically told them to stand down because they were so afraid, even with all of that artillery, even with all of that protection. They were waiting on shields. They were waiting on extra stuff. I mean, they were cowards, basically, despite having that enormous amount of money and the proportion of the town's funds. So nothing mm-hmm. is going to change the way this was their human choices that led to this, not the material at their disposal. And so then that begs the question, what does policing as currently constructed do for our society?
I mean, I think it's a very fair question. And, you know, just it should be noted, too, that the school district in Uvalde has now said that their response is they're going to hire more police officers for the school district. So that's already, you know, starting to happen. And look, I'm not a, you know, combat tactician or anything like that. But, you know, handguns themselves, especially with body armor, are designed for close quarters combat, right? So, like, of course you would want in a situation like that to be decked out with all the things, you know, that could maybe make a conflict like that easier. But when you're hearing kids screaming for help and are being shot and you are already equipped with a deadly weapon with the training to use that, I don't know. It's just sort of like, what do we have to wait for these guys to get like Gundam suits before they're going to come and like help out children? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
And also there's a police code to this that I'm pretty sure said, like, you wait for, once you have two law enforcement amassed, you breach, right? I'm pretty sure like their handbook literally said that and they didn't follow that.
They had 60 officers standing outside the school talking with one another. And as we've gotten more of like the leaked audio from you know, from the shooting, they were very concerned about the way this was going to look to the public. They were already talking about, oh, is this going to make us look bad? Are we going to be, you know, maligned for this? I mean, think about that. That's where your mind is going when something horrible like that is happening. It really does boggle the mind. And I mean, I must say, like, you know, I think that this is a moment where it's time to believe police. You know, when they say I shot this, you know, black kid because I was fearing for my life, we should believe them that they're scared. And they're worried as a class of people. And, you know, we really need to take that seriously as we're trying to build public policy that actually works to help defend, you know, defend people from these kind of horrors. That, like, right now what we have is we have a lot of scared people walking around with access to a lot of post-military equipment, you know, are able to walk around with a handgun and are able to basically impose their will on people.
And to me, their strategy seems clear that they're trying to wait out the national media coverage. Like these cops are probably used to dealing with the same people in the same town. And I mean, frankly, it's you can mirror it onto the federal level right now with Republicans talking about different door strategies, having one point of entry. They don't. I genuinely believe they don't actually believe that's a solution. That they are just trying to throw something out there like a squirrel, like look at that, so that in a month people forget about this and they don't have to act. I'm wondering what your take is on that.
On the police department and the media, I think that's 100% true. I mean, you know, the larger kind of mass media hub near them is San Antonio, which is about 40 minutes away. And you can see how the police have been treating national media or even just like state, Texas media in general. Yeah, I think 100% they're hoping that eventually people are going to get tired of their accommodations in Uvalde and, you know, go back down to Austin and San Antonio, and maybe they'll drive back if something happens. But yeah, 100%, I think that they're trying to wait this out. I mean, hell, they're even trying to wait out the state government at this point. So, you know, let alone reporters, they're basically turning their backs on the higher authority in the state of Texas. I mean, as for national Republicans, I mean, I think it's absolute disgrace, to be talking about doors like that. I also hate the language. I know this is a small point, but I hate the language of calling schools targets, saying we need to harden our targets. I mean, it just shows just how perverse this crisis has gotten, that we talk about the place where we educate children, our next generation, as a target. It's just endlessly clear that these people have no real interest in doing anything about it. You know, after the shooting happened, people rightfully were, making hay about the fact that Abbott and other state leadership was going to be speaking at the NRA convention. And when Beto came and confronted Abbott, people have probably seen that clip, at the press conference, one of the guys in there was saying, like, how dare you politicize this? How dare you politicize this? I'm sorry. At this point, it already is politicized. Who is speaking at the NRA convention? Greg Abbott, right? Who is speaking at the NRA convention? Ted Cruz, Republican, Ken Paxton, etc. And now, while, you know, after praying and thinking about it, some didn't speak at all, or I know Abbott sent in a video message. It just shows that they have already politicized this issue. And it's always really disgusting when they sit here and say, after something like this happens, like, how dare anybody try to politicize a tragedy when they've been, walking and, surviving on this politically for a very, very long time.
It's funny you mentioned Ted Cruz, because you sent this tweet to me of him blaming the Green New Deal for electricity costs in Texas. I mean, given the grid failure that we saw, when was that? I mean, was that 6 months ago? God, time went together. It was in 2020?
Wait, no, sorry. It was 2021. Sorry. Yeah, I'm losing my mind, too.
Okay. Okay. All right. So it was last year. Just making sure that, my mind isn't completely gone already. What has the update been has there been any changes to the grid in Texas? Because this is going to happen again.
So right now it's, near 100 degrees, and it looks like it's probably going to be 100 degrees every day in June. ERCOT, which, governs the system here, has said that, we're in a crisis situation, and we might have record-breaking demand for electricity throughout the weekend, right? Which means for people, the threat of blackouts. And, in the same way that it's really dangerous when it's cold, when you run out of, the ability to control the temperature in your own home, it's very dangerous when it's like this. Nothing. And I wanted to bring up that Cruz thing, because he's trying to blame Biden You know,
for the Green New Deal that hasn't happened.
Which is so ridiculous. And like, you know, Texas has expanded its wind and solar, you know, which is certainly helpful. Of course, they try to blame that after the winter storm when, again, it was natural gas pipelines that froze over. And I just want to make this point as you know, as a socialist, somebody who wants to see a different kind of system here. Why do these providers fail to weatherize their systems? It's because they make a decision that is much more profitable for them to just keep everything online. And if, yeah, they lose out on revenue for a couple of days, so be it. If they end up being one of the winners who doesn't lose out when the power is going out from other providers, they get to make a lot of money. And the crisis in Texas is caused by this decentralized, over-marketized system where it's a constant auction house on electricity. So prices can shoot up dramatically in a matter of minutes. And not only have they not done very much to deal with this, they passed some kind of like, oh, weatherize your stuff, but we have no enforcement mechanisms. So just like a nice little letter from the government here. And by the way, all these people donate millions of dollars to Greg Abbott. And they did immediately after he basically slowballed any kind of response to this. But this is not the only crisis, but just shows how ridiculous it is here. After all this has been happening, guess who comes to town? All these Bitcoin boys and little freaks to try to take advantage of weak and underfunded city governments to try to create contracts with city governments and providers to get a set rate for electricity, right? So that they can constantly mine Bitcoins. And people were like, well, this is great. They're using this, their argument. It's like, oh, we're using up unused power and then we'll encourage more investment in capacity. Well, one, that's not what's happening. And two, what ends up happening is in a moment like this, right, where we're actually saying, everybody, we need to conserve energy. Prices are going to be going up. They're sitting there, right, paying those same prices while taking on a huge amount of power to mine Bitcoins, right? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. And Greg Abbott not only is approving this, he's taking pictures with them and saying, look, Texas is running at the speed of business, right? I mean, just absolutely irresponsible at this moment. And we need to, you know, we need to be building up a much stronger movement on this. And I think that like power itself is something not just in Texas, but for the left in general, is something that I think is a very viable way to fight for the things that we care about. One, dealing with climate change, but two, creating good union jobs, making sure that people have access, you know, to being able to afford electricity in their homes, right? There's a lot of fights that can be happening. And I think, at least in Texas, like this is a huge political opportunity for people to show that, like, look, they don't care about you at all. Not only will they not make it better, they're actually willing to make it worse for no real benefit to themselves.
Or for crypto. I mean, like the fact that they're able to negotiate some sort of fixed rate for themselves in order to mine. I mean, I don't. Did that actually happen or whatever? The fact that they feel like they can negotiate some sort of fixed price for themselves for this incredibly electricity intensive, massive project. I mean, people don't. Bitcoin is like when they advertise it as this democratizing force. It's incredibly environmentally wasteful, and part of why these like disaster capitalist Bitcoin bros go to countries in South America to exploit them is because they can like work around and still still use all of their energy in a predatory manner. But that shows that the price fixing is possible if Abbott was interested in it, but he's only interested in providing it for capitalists that are going to bring business to
totally
Texas.
And like you have to understand, like our grid is like what like the most privatized grid. So you actually have, you know, providers competing against each other. So it's a constant auction house. And that means that prices can just, you know, skyrocket exponentially. So whenever you hear Ted Cruz going on about the windmills and the solar rigs, it's like, no, friend, it is 100% an over-marketized system. Not any of these kind of, you know, new technologies. But yeah, I mean, it's a joke. And like beyond that, like in the same vein as what you're talking about, you know, like in El Salvador with Bitcoin, right? They do that internally here with, you know, cities that are struggling. So like Denton, Texas, had, you know, a bunch of shadowy, you know, crypto guys show up and say, we'll pay off the city's debts if you let us set up shop here and eat into your electricity market, right? So certainly a bad decision by the government there, but it's a decision that comes out of like the crisis that so many, you know, cities and towns across this country are facing, where it's like they don't have the revenue to basically provide services or to pay, you know, to take care of their debts. And these are the guys who are going to come in moments like that and take advantage of entire communities with very, very serious consequences.
I wanted to turn to some of the other controversy in the news this week. Controversy, ridiculously drummed up controversy. Did you know, David, that in Dallas, there was a confidence building exercise with drag queens that is now considered grooming? And it's such a massive crisis. I said on Twitter, it's like taking your kid to a Broadway show. It's just costumes and yeah, dancing. Yeah.
It's so bad it has people moving to Texas to avoid it.
I mean, like now they're literally going to try. I mean, what was it? The state senator that introduced, or state rep
introduced
legislation,
yeah,
to ban kids from drag shows. They are really accelerating this anti-trans boogeyman stuff throughout the country, but particularly in Texas.
And it's very scary. And just, you know, because people have made this point a lot, you know, it's horrifying how quickly they are willing to move on that and not on, you know, the gun issue. I just wanted to note that, you know, they called a special investigative like committee in Texas on the gun issue, which has only subpoena power. It's not a legislative session or anything like that, which means that like even best case scenario, they want to do something. We won't get legislation on that till probably next summer. A whole year from now. But I just bring that up to show the difference in how willing that side is to, you know, gum up culture war stuff. I mean, you know, I can't sit here and act offended about a drag show. I think it's absolutely ridiculous and performative, and I wish it could just be something where we could point at how prudish and weird conservatives are, but it has serious consequences. As folks probably know, trigger warning, I'm talking about a suicide here, but a young trans person committed suicide here in Texas because, you know, the government is now investigating families and is threatening to rip them away from their families. I mean, absolutely horrific. And I just want to say, as, you know, as a Texan and somebody who grew up here, like, I get frustrated sometimes when you see people like the Tim Pools and the Rubens, and they always try to paint this picture of Texas and what Texas is like, right? And say, oh, look, everybody's moving to this place. Because it's one, the picture they paint of Texas is always really distorted. It's always funny that they're not from here or live here. And two, it really scares me because the only kind of people who actually are going to be motivated by a pool or a Reuben type to move here and actually do it are like some of the worst people who I want as far away from this state as possible. I just want to share, you know, my experience. Like, I grew up when I was a kid, my mom and I and my little brother and sister, we went and we moved in with my aunt who is in the lesbian community here. So I grew up in the gay and LGBTQ community here in Texas. And that is as much Texas as anything else to me, right? And it's always been here and it always will. And these kind of hate-filled people who are trying to use culture war for their own political gain and trying to, you know, work up some of the most psychotic and dangerous people in this society against other human beings have blood on their hands, and they need to be opposed at every single level. It's a part of, you know, that culture is a part of the culture here as much as it is everywhere else. I mean, like the gay community, the LGBTQ community has always been here and it always will. And it really, really infuriates me when I see these kind of bigots try to act like this is some kind of like invasion, right? Or something that's being brought in here instead of something that comes from us.
And from a national level, like these pundits who fetishize Texas, I mean, that's the thing that, like, that I can't speak for you, but that would bug me because it's like it completely, I mean, it's the one of the three biggest countries in the state in terms of influence and size. I'm like forgetting in terms of population, that's probably California, but Texas in size is massive.
Well, you're speaking my Texas Nationals there.
Yeah.
Texas as a country.
Oh, did I say country?
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about seating today on the show. But I mean, that erases many, many struggles. It also often erases a vibrant and large Latino population in Texas as well, in order to uphold some sort of like myth of Republican cowboys that they want to use to largely undercut like social programs on a national level.
To be fair, when it comes to Tejanos and Latinos in Texas too, I think liberals do a pretty good job of ignoring them as well.
Fair,
but absolutely. And I wanted to note, just on that kind of fantasy that we get from those kind of right YouTuber characters or whatever, it's very funny when they're talking about this moment. They never really mention that it's in Dallas. You know, they sort of just sort of dance around it because it sort of, destroys the world that they're trying to create in people's heads. But yeah, I mean, I think going back to all of these issues that, we've been talking about today, I think this is why it's not the number one issue, but it's something that, we take very seriously at Left Reckoning. You know, really like taking hold of your history becomes really important. Because what they're trying to do, there is a line, in my opinion, between the Republicans trying to wage war on history in Texas, basically trying to make it so public universities can't teach like real history, and all of these kind of things. Speakers are being challenged by like the GOP in Texas and said, "Oh, we're going to pull funding for that kind of stuff." There's a direct thread to that, to all of the other things that we're seeing, from the fake gummed up created controversy about trans rights in Texas to the gun issue. It all comes from this kind of fantasy of what Texas was that is created today by a purposeful right-wing movement. And it's really, really dangerous, and it's something that's worth pushing up. And if people want more of that, feel free to check out Left Reckoning, because we tell that history a lot. But it's very, very worrying because it is erasure of people, and it emboldens some of the most dangerous folks in our community, which every community has bigots out there. But this kind of tacit wink that you get from the Texas GOP when they're saying, yeah, we're going to tattle on your neighbors if you think that your neighbor has a trans kid, call the state. And we're going to come and get involved and harass them. I mean, that's complicit. That's being absolutely complicit in this hate monger that's going on.
And it's already happening. Like, I'll put this article up here, Bradley, WFLA. But this is this trans child attempted suicide because they were reported that had a mental health scare. And because they were going through transition, were reported to the state. And the state got involved. Like, this is state harassment of kids. Immediately. I mean, this was... It's like this wasn't even you couldn't be sort of like a byproduct of this effort. This is exactly what this was always going to lead to. You have kids who transition, I want to spell out the puberty blocker thing too, because we have kids who socially transition, and then all of a sudden you're going to go through puberty. And puberty blockers are very important for those kids who have already transitioned into their preferred gender, because what happens if you can't get those puberty blockers? You go through puberty into a body that you don't want. So of course you're going to, this is going to lead to suicides. Of course it's going to.
Of course. This is a part of like a larger story of what's happening in Texas about families of trans teens basically getting together with the ACLU and Lambda Legal. They're filing a lawsuit on behalf of three families, and I think other families are joining this because they are being investigated, and this isn't just like one-offs. There are multiple families that aren't included already in the suit by the government of Texas for providing gender affirming care to their kids. This is going to be a large legal fight, I think. They're also the lawsuit's also representing, I believe, a large LGBTQ organization within Texas, which has also been targeted.
According to the lawsuit, the minor was admitted to a local hospital and referred to an outpatient psychiatric facility. Staff learned that he had been prescribed hormone therapy for treatment of gender dysphoria, and according to the lawsuit, told him and his mother that the family might be reported for child abuse because of Abbott's letter and DFPS's new rule. Less than a week after the minor was discharged from the facility, the lawsuit says a child welfare investigator arrived at the family's home. What are we doing here?
Yeah. I mean, it's extremely, extremely worrying. And, you know, it's, I think people who were, you know, when it was just, we care about the integrity of women's sports, it's been amazing how quickly it's moved over to like, we're going to come for the life of children.
Right.
I mean, it's like that moved extremely fast. And I think that the Republicans think that they have a winning ticket on, you know, stoking up fears, not just about, you know, trans folks too, but just general homophobia. And, you know, it's something that it is pretty shocking to see how quickly things can regress. It's thought that we had sort of turned a corner on this, and it's very quickly coming back, you know, to feeling like it's the early 2000s again.
Oh, yeah.
When we're talking about these issues.
That Blaze TV girl who went into that.
We played yesterday.
Posted a picture that we played yesterday. When she posted those images of the drag show, she called it demonic.
Yeah.
Like, that's how retrograde this mindset is. And that's not her being poetic.
No, that's what it is a fundamentalist Christian movement that is well coordinated and politically expedient for someone like Greg Abbott, Ken Paxton in Texas, but also, of course, Ron DeSantis in Florida and other governors across the country, less high profile, because they finding a someone to demonize is helpful for them. And I think that they saw the trans issue, the existence of trans people, which freaks out a certain section of the country who are not used to it as they were used to gay people, which has become more normalized in culture over the past few decades. They saw that as a way to reverse course. It was an opening to demonize trans people and thus broaden the scope and also begin to demonize gay people as well. And it's just like Christian fascism laundered through pearl clutching about, you know, women swimming or drag shows in Texas. That's really what it is.
And, you know, I take this extremely seriously, you know, and I'm going to, you know, point out, you know, the failures of the Democrats on this, not because I think it's like doing both sidesism, but because this is the real threat, right? So you see like this kind of real, like new moral panic about, you know, gay people and trans people. And, you know, that works up a certain group of people and might be maybe slightly attractive to a larger group of people, but it's not like their number one thing. Right, their number one issue. And the only reason that this stuff can is like allowed to thrive and be viable for the Republican Party is if the left and the Democratic Party in particular is sort of failing at creating a positive option that like people, you know what I'm saying, like people like who might be motivated to vote for Republican because they're very worked up about something their pastor told them. I think it's a much easier case to say, well, you know, we need Medicare for all, $15 an hour, and just like winning those kind of fights so that this kind of cheap culture war stuff that the Republican Party tries to play, just like it doesn't have the sway or the power to overcome something like that. And
well,
when
there's
you
a
sit
vacuum,
on,
right? And so it's being filled by that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Didn't mean to cut you off. Go on.
No. I mean, that's exactly it. It's just like, you know, this stuff is dangerous and it's worrying and we have to oppose it directly. But also remember that, as you said, like this comes out of a political vacuum where the Republicans, they don't have very much to offer people who don't make $500,000 plus a year, right? In like actual material terms. So they try to find these kind of things that they think can like work up a segment of the population, hope that that will carry them to victory. And, you know, it just should be a slam dunk to be able to beat them on actual things that help people out in their everyday life. And that will squash, you know, most of not the entire existence of like bigotry and homophobia in society, but the system that empowers Republicans to utilize this and legislate it on it.
David Griscom of Left Reckoning, thanks so much for being here today, David. Everyone check out Left Reckoning with Matt and David here. It's great stuff.
Yeah. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. Going to be doing a think tank for all of our patrons. So get your questions in this afternoon.
All right. Yeah. Boom.
Well, thanks so much, everybody. Hope to see you soon.
See you soon. Have a great weekend.
See you, David.
All right. With that said, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the New York DSA slate. We'll be right back. We are back. We are back now, and we are joined by DSA organizer Silianos Karolidis, we are currently trying to make workshop the internet for Samithi Kumar, who is a campaign organizer for Housing for Justice for All and the NYC DSA co-chair. Just some internet issues here. But for now, thank you so much for being here, Silianos, to talk about this historic New York's DSA slate.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having us. If Samithi is here, she's really fantastic, and I hope she makes it on. And I'm super excited to talk about all of our candidates and electoral strategy and everything in between.
Awesome. Well, I'm very excited for that, too. So while we're workshopping Samithi's internet, maybe she can call into the phones, although we would need to call in ourselves. But that's something for another day. Apologies for the technical difficulties. So a few weeks ago, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsed the entire full slate of New York Democratic Socialist candidates here in New York State. And this is the largest slate in New York DSA history. It's called the For the Many slate, and it has a variety of different candidates. Can you just talk about, one, what that endorsement means in terms of a national profile for some of your candidates and maybe helping with the organizing? And two, how exciting it is that it's such a large slate and has, from my research and from my understanding, such a diverse slate with diverse experiences and backgrounds, and, you know, multi-pronged approaches in different districts.
Yeah, we're really excited and terrified. It's a huge slate and it's an incredible amount of work, but I am so thrilled that we're taking it on. We also call it the Green New York slate because we uniquely highlighted climate crisis as one of our top priority issues, and that's uniting all the candidates among so many other things that is bringing them all together. I will list all of their names, but I'm not going to go into detail right now because I don't want to make everyone sit here and listen to every single bit about them. But it is Sarah Hanna-Shrestha in the Mid-Hudson Valley, which is upstate, Vanessa Agudelo, who's in Peekskill, which again is upstate, and then down here in New York City, we've got Iyapa Sarutupak in Lower Manhattan, we've got Kirana Lane in East New York, Sami Namir Olivares in Bushwick, Cypress Hills, also East New York, David Alexis in Flatbush, and Kristen Gonzalez in my neighborhood here in Astoria, Long Island City, and Stuytown. And we're really, really, really thrilled that AOC has endorsed the entire slate. I think there's a number of reasons why she did it. One, she's obviously a DSA-endorsed elected and coming in more to this idea of coalition work and kind of block politics that socialists need to act together in order to make effective change. And then two, she's obviously a federal legislator, and that's where she spends 99% of her time. But I think the more things we've been able to win in New York City and New York State, the more it's becoming clear to her and many other folks in Congress and across the country that local politics, state-level politics, has a ridiculous amount of potential to affect workers, to talk to regular people and, you know, politicize them, bring them into the project, and nationwide to affect politics. An idea here in New York, a bill that we can pass here, can make it onto the national stage and become a model for what policy we want to see at the federal level. And
I think that that is the best way. I mean, for me, and why I said I was supportive of the entire DSA slate is because and why I'm so encouraged by what you're doing is, you know, one, you can see the gains of New York DSA based on past candidates who have won, but they were fewer, right? I mean, the 2018 midterm elections, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Julia Salazar, 2020, there was a larger slate that won, but now this is even exponentially larger than all of that. And my belief really is that the left, specifically in these blue states where corporate Democrats have allowed to kind of reign supreme, needs a apparatus, a coalition that can wield its own power. And my belief is that DSA is the best way to do that within the state. And so in terms of the numbers, was that part of your strategy of trying to brought in the coalition. We're calling into the phones here, so hopefully we can get Samithi on now. But was that part of your strategy to kind of shoot as many darts as possible in order to create an apparatus that can flex its muscle in the levers of power in New York State?
Yes and no. Every single endorsement that we make is a very meticulous and deliberative process. And especially when you have a really large chapter like New York City, there's a lot of good-natured and healthy political fighting over these endorsements. And we made certain decisions in New York City based on a number of different factors, including where we thought geographically we could win, what seats were important for us to win, what type of neighborhoods, what type of demographic voters we wanted to speak to, and also, as you may have heard about all this redistricting stuff, how we felt regarding redistricting, how that would affect our races. And two of the members of our slate are not in New York City. So those weren't New York City chapter decisions alone. One of them, Sarah Hanna Shrestha, she's in the Mid-Hudson Valley. The other, Vanessa Agudelo, she's in the Lower Hudson Valley. And those were two separate DSA chapters that made the decision to endorse them. And here in New York City, we have them on our slate, messaging-wise, comms-wise, and we have a tool called the Multi-Candidate Committee, or MCC. That's the For the Many committee that you might hear about often.
Right.
And we elected to include those two candidates in the MCC and give them additional coordinating and comm support, all this sort of high-level support that we can provide, because we are increasingly recognizing, despite our power in New York City, New York City alone cannot win us the things that we're aiming for here in New York. And so we're reaching out to Mid-Hudson Valley, Lower Hudson Valley, and in 2 years, maybe other places across the state, to widen our impact, broaden our reach, make it clear that this progressive left, socialist left movement is a threat to every politician across the state, no matter what kind of district they're in, and it's something that can unite the working class across demographics, across district boundaries, and that is going to continue to make victories, make gains.
I'm going to bring in Samithi Kumar here, who is on the phones. We were able to bring her in without any video. Samithi, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Sorry about my internet.
It's all good. It's all good. I was talking with Silianos a bit about the strategy behind the broad DSA slate, but I do think that is notable too. That it is not just your focus is not just in New York City. The fact that it creeps up into the Hudson Valley and other areas of New York. I mean, what can I ask? What strategic decisions went into those specific areas outside of the city limits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at what we can win in New York City and in New York State, a lot of power happens at the state level. So if we want to win universal health care, a Green New Deal, you know, good cause eviction, universal rent control, all of these things are decided at the state level in New York State. So for years now, New York City DSA and our chapters across the state in the Mid-Hudson Valley and the Lower Hudson Valley and Buffalo and Syracuse have been really, our eyes have been on state power so that we can really win material gains for the working class. And so this is just an extension of that project. We're going to try and win races outside of New York City so that we can win policy on a state level that can actually deliver for folks across the state. And that's really the reason why we're doing it.
Samithi, you're a Housing Justice for All campaign organizer and advocate for housing. How central was that to the candidates that you chose to back in DSA? Because I frankly think, at least on a national level, it's largely just completely absent from the conversation, but it could not be more necessary, particularly in New York.
Right. I mean, housing has been one of our chapter's priorities for a long time. And obviously, it's a priority for the working class where the rent is extremely too high and our homelessness crisis keeps skyrocketing and people like desperately want a change in our housing system. And so a lot of folks who are running this year and who ran in 2020 ran on housing. In 2020, it was the height of the pandemic and people were running on canceling rent and extending the eviction moratorium.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, wait, now you're here. You're back. You cut out for like 2 seconds.
Oh, no. we really need some internet for all, yes. Juliana's can talk about. but I would say yes, housing is a central part of our platform in New York City DSA and across the state. And we really need our state government to start, you know, doing some.
Okay, Samantha, you might have cut out again, but it seems like you might have been wrapping up a little bit. I wanted to talk a bit about I touched on this earlier, but why I think and maybe either of you can answer this, or maybe Stylianos, you can while Smithy's figuring out her internet. But you know. There is real power in candidates running within infrastructure, right? That can pay dividends for years and years to come. The number one example of this, in my opinion, on a federal level is, even though it's not socialist politics in terms of what we favor, someone like Stacey Abrams, who ran but was unsuccessful, but the infrastructure from her run set up Democratic wins later on. On the state level, we can be a bit more radical, obviously, but that's why it's important too that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign and that success is not a flash in the pan individual success. It's a part of a larger DSA infrastructure, democratic socialist infrastructure within the state. Was that a part of your calculus too, is making sure that there's solidarity among candidates, so there's power in numbers? Perhaps I'm reframing kind of a question from earlier, but I think that's really what sticks out to me when I was reading about this slate.
There's something that we have that not a lot of folks know about, and I'm super happy to tell everyone about today. It's called the Socialists in Office Committee, and that is a committee made up of all of our current elected, so Zagran, Marcella, Emily, Farah, Julia, and Jabari, and numerous different organizers across New York City. So that's me, Sumithi, lots of other folks whose names you don't know. And the purpose of this committee, we meet once a week for about an hour and a half, and we've got a couple different group chats where we coordinate in between those meetings. We essentially coordinate all the activities of all the current electeds. And I'm mentioning this in response to your question because we recognized really long time ago, we can't afford to just work really hard, get somebody elected, they have good politics, and then leave them alone, right? Mm. The incredible amount of pressure across the United States, but especially here in New York and Albany, to force someone even slightly to the left of center to conform to right-wing capitalist politics would crush even the best possible candidate. And so when you see someone like Julia Salazar or Zohran Mamdani, and you're like, wow, they're doing a really great job, they seem to be having really good politics, you know, Marcella, Emily, Farah, Jabari, it is in part because they're really good candidates and they've become good elected officials, but it's also because when there is a climate issue, they can reach out to me and the entire eco-socialist working group, everyone on climate in New York City DSA is behind them. When there's a housing issue, that Good Cause Eviction campaign, that was entirely coordinated, run, and operated by our housing comrades. When there are healthcare issues, there are hundreds of people doing all of that canvassing work, coordinating work, and then the policy and research work. So when you're looking at our slate right now, all of the candidates that you are thinking about and hopefully electing, Kristen Gonzalez is not running just to put Kristen Gonzalez in the state senate. You're also going to be putting my work, Sumithi's work, the work of hundreds of DSA members behind these candidates to keep them accountable, to make sure that they do what they say they're going to do. and to support them so that when leadership in Albany, Carl Hasty, Andrea Stewart Cousins, and Kathy Hochul, when they come down and they say, you have to conform or else there's going to be consequences, they get to turn back and say, look at these thousands of DSA members. They got me. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do what I was elected to do because I know there is a movement that is going to ensure I have the tools, the power to achieve that, and that you, Kathy Hochul, Carl Hasty, Andrea Stewart Cousins, you can't do a thing about that. That's really powerful.
Right. And you mentioned Jabari Brisport and Julia Salazar, two victories for your slate and just for the left here in New York. Samithi, if you're there, what has been your reaction internally in DSA to their how they've been up against immense opposition in Albany, but how they've brought DSA's slate and their ideas to the halls of power now that they've been elected?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely hard. And there's a lot of pressure from the leadership in the legislature to do exactly what Stylianos was just saying, to conform, to go with the party line. But our electeds haven't done that. And a really good example that I'm thinking about now is last year when Governor Cuomo was accused of a whole array of scandals for his impeachment. And there was, you know, after when all of the investigations were happening, there were documents that came out that said, you know, we can't talk, you know, Melissa DeRosa and all of the Cuomo operatives were trying to buy off elected officials and trying to get them to conform and not raise a big deal about what was going on. And they said in their notes, we can't talk to Zohran because he's DSA. He can't be.
Wow. It looks like we still might have that interrupting issue, but I mean, I think we kind of got Samithi's point there.
Sorry, guys.
No.
It's okay.
Stylianos, why don't you you finish up? This will be our final question. I'll let you guys go. But some of what Samithi was saying there.
Yeah, like Samithi was saying in the notes, you saw a text message from Cuomo's second in command. We have no play with Zohran. And I think that's indicative of the work that we're doing. They know, you know, the people in power know that this is a new block of people going to Albany that they have absolutely no influence over. That the real people that are calling the shots behind what Jabari or Zohran or Marcella or Emily or Julia or Farah are doing are the working class that got them elected. And that's terrifying to Albany. You know, you see what just happened these past few months. We almost passed the Build Public Renewables Act here in New York State. It is unprecedented legislation. It's gigantic. And there was an unprecedented movement to get it passed. I think everybody in Albany is, I don't know what I'm allowed to say on this show, pooping their pants right now. I hope that's okay. Everyone
oh,
in
more
Albany,
than okay. You can you could have done the S bomb too. We're loose, word. Especially on Casual Friday.
They're defecating themselves because they realize that there is this increasingly growing uproar of people across the state that are paying attention, that are recognizing they have the power to change things, and they're taking action. You know, Sarahana Shrestha, who's running in the Mid-Hudson Valley, she's a climate organizer. She's running against this assembly member that's been there forever, Kevin Cahill. And Kevin Cahill isn't signed on to any of our bills. But two folks overheard him in the assembly the 2 days before session ended, begging Carl Hasty. He was telling him, quote, you have to pass this bill. It's going to cost me my seat. And we love to hear that because we know that we are putting the fear of God in these people and we're doing that together. We are not going to be able to do that with a few good individuals that are not bound by a movement. We're only going to do that with 6 and now soon to be 13 socialists in office backed by a movement of thousands across the state of working class people that are ready to keep them accountable, ready to give them orders, and ready to back them up when the going gets tough, because it will, and only together can we achieve that sort of change.
Samithi Kumar, campaign organizer for Housing Justice for All, and also the New York City DSA co-chair and DSA organizer, Stylianos Karolidis. Thank you so much to you both for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Can I say one last thing?
Sure.
If folks are motivated, you know, I wouldn't be a good organizer if I didn't do this. If folks are motivated, you can go to fortheturnout.nyc to sign up for
a canvassing number four? Trip. Number four?
No, the word spelled out.
Okay.
fortheturnout.nyc. You can sign up for a phone banking shift if you're not in New York, or a canvassing shift if you are. And all of those great things I said, you too can be a part of it. It's really awesome. You can be part of this movement with us. Doesn't require you to have any experience, any knowledge, any special skills. We're all just regular working class people, and we'd love to have you on board.
Incredible. And you can see at the top of that page a really cool illustration of the slate of DSA candidates there. Thanks so much for your time today. Thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Thanks, guys. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program, the free part of this program. We're going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, so this weekend, Think Tank, so for patrons of Left Reckoning, which you should be, patreon.com/Left Reckoning, we're going to be doing our Think Tank, which we didn't do one last month, but we usually do one once a month where we just take questions and chat about stuff. Also tonight at the twitch.tv/Left Reckoning feed, I'm going to be playing NBA 2K probably around 6 or 6:30 or so. I'll be playing NBA 2K on. I'll be playing my team mode, where I have Invincible Michael Jordan and Yao Ming, who's 99 overall as well. So and I'll probably be talking about some South Dakota politics, and maybe some of, depending on how bad of a mood I am, I might be put on ether background music and start talking about some people who joined the anti-trans bandwagon recently. Mm. But I'm not sure about that. But Twitch.tv.
We'll see if you have a drink in you or something like that.
Twitch.tv/Left Reckoning to watch me tonight play NBA 2K.
All right, folks, heading into the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second, hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start life.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire, Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you.
All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.